You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia, and this is the American Hour. Thank you for joining us. We're doing a special Thursday broadcast. That means Paula is not going to be with us, my lovely co-host Paula Lazan Osman. Sorry about that, but we were able to get J.E. Dyer, a columnist and author, to join us on the show today to do an interview. We had initially talked about maybe just doing a podcast and doing a tape recording and then posting it or using it in a future show. And I thought, you know what, let's just do a broadcast. I'm around. Let's do it. So she's going to be calling in here in a few minutes, and we're going to talk about her blog, her writing, and one of her recent articles that really got my attention. Her website is The Optimistic Conservative. You can go check that out at any time. And she recently did an article, again, that really caught my attention, entitled, "It's Not the Entitlements, It's the Discretionary Spending." Oh, a great article. We're going to talk about that. And she's written a bunch of other articles and some since that article. That was actually published on the 7th of July. I don't think I saw it till a few days later. But she's got some great information for us and great insight. Now, she's also, just so happens, I didn't know this. I contacted her to see if she'd come on the show and to tell her what a great article was, because any of you that have listened to me in the past know that I'm pretty big on the whole discretionary spending thing, that that's one of our big problems, and that we've got to get that under control. It's less about the entitlements than it is about discretionary spending. It's less about entitlements than discretionary spending, correct? And so when I read that article, it's like listening to myself almost, except she had a little more eloquent way of putting things. And so that's why I wanted to get her on the show and get her thoughts and talk to her about some of her other articles that she's done and an upcoming book. Now, just so that you know, next week, we're going to be broadcasting on Tuesday and Wednesday. Normally for the summer, we've been broadcasting on Monday and Wednesday, and that's because we decided to follow the lead of our politicians and only work 2 days a week. Now, I know with this debt ceiling issue coming up, our politicians have been working a little bit harder than normal, but for the most part, their plan was to only work 2 days a week this summer, so that's what we decided to do. And it is summertime, people going on vacation. Well, in about another week, I'm going to be going on vacation, and so I've got some great guests or some great hosts filling in for me. Now, there were guests briefly yesterday. We were going to have Craig Sawyer, the Navy SEAL, on the show yesterday, and his flight got into Atlanta late. But he's there for a project with the Wounded Warriors in Action Foundation, and they're going to take some of these wounded warriors out riding in, or actually racing, driving Formula One cars. What a deal. And then after that, they're going to go do some sniper shooting and high-powered rifle shooting and probably some other type of shooting. And that's one of Craig's specialties. Well, in any case, he and his good friend and PR person, Jill Trammell, have agreed to do the show, host the show for a four-part series. So a Monday and Wednesday, then another Monday and Wednesday. That'll be the 27th and 29th, and then the Monday and Wednesday of the first week in August. And Jill wants to do an expose on the TSA whistleblowers. Now, I know they'll be talking about some other things, such as the Wounded Warrior organization that they work with and what's going on with that. And, of course, Craig will be talking about Navy SEALs and the shows that he's done on the History Show so far, Top Sniper and Top Shot and things like that. And also he was involved in a cover on Maximum Warriors in the Maxim magazine. So he's got a lot of things to talk about, and he's been working closely with the History Channel here for some time. There's a project that they're going to be working on, or maybe already working on, that will be coming out, and it'll be taking wounded warriors out into the woods hunting. And, you know, when you think about it, this is the kind of thing that is, it's not combat, it's not, you know, out there on the battleground or anything like that, or the battlefield, but it's something that they're familiar with. They're with other military members or former military members, and they're doing something that they know, shooting rifles, shooting guns. And so there's going to be a competition coming up, not too distant future, as well as the hunting shows that they're going to do on, I believe, the History Channel as well. So it's a great opportunity to help them get beyond some of their battle scars and back into mainstream life in an environment that they are familiar with. So that's what he's going to be talking about to some degree on the show. So don't miss that. The last last Monday and Wednesday of this month and the first Monday and Wednesday of August, Craig Sawyer, along with Jill Trammell and the Wounded Warriors in Action Foundation, but also talking about and having each show discuss a different aspect of and bringing on guests that have firsthand knowledge of some of the issues going on with the TSA and the security in our airports. All right, and then next week we've got Ambassador Stanley Escudero on Wednesday. You don't want to miss that. Tuesday we'll be talking about current events. No Monday show, so Tuesday current events. Paul will be joining me back with me on Tuesday and again on Wednesday, and we will be talking with the ambassador, former three-time ambassador, who has intimate knowledge of the Middle East and particularly Egypt and spent some time there some years ago and knows the gentleman who was asked to go over there and work with them when they first had their uprising. And he was a former ambassador, not Escudero, but the gentleman that he used to work for was the former ambassador to Egypt, and he knows him well. So he's got some great insight into what's going on over there. And as a side note, and maybe not even a side note, Ambassador Escudero was in Iran during the Shah, the fall of the Shah, and he was undercover as well, and he was going into mosques and listening to what was going on and taking notes and getting that information back to us so that we knew what was really going on. Unlike now in some of these countries, we don't know what's going on. We don't know who's behind the uprising. We don't know who's coordinating things. Well, Ambassador Escudero was in Iran and was able to get those answers so that we knew. So, and then he's got plenty of other stories from when he was ambassador, some incredible stories that you don't want to miss. So we will just kind of wing it in terms of what we talk about. We'll certainly talk about current events, what he's involved in with politics now and helping get candidates elected, and also what stories, interesting stories he may feel he wants to tell. So don't call in and ask questions. Please do. Feel free to do that, and you don't want to miss that. Of course, the call-in number always is 310-982-4145. Now, we got some breaking news, I guess if you want to call it that, the Mail Online, and this is a British. I find all kinds of interesting articles on British and Canadian newspapers that you don't find here in the U.S., at least not until it gets out there and the local mainstream media has to pick it up. But we already knew this, but I mean, here's the actual facts. U.S. gives billions of dollars in foreign aid to the world's richest countries, not just poor countries, but richest countries, and then asked to borrow it back. I mean, can you believe that? Let me give you an example. The U.S. is providing hundreds of millions of dollars in foreign aid to some of the richest countries. The Congressional Research Service released the report last month, which shows that in 2010, the U.S. handed out a total of $1.4 billion to 16 countries that held at least $10 billion in Treasury securities. Well, if they held $10 billion in Treasury securities, and you think about it, we gave them, what, $1.4? They could have just cashed. They needed the money. They could have cashed in their Treasury securities. Four countries in the world's top 10 richest received foreign aid last year. China received $27 million. Now, everybody's familiar with China and the fact they own a lot of our debt. We gave, as foreign aid, gave them. Here you go. In your pocket, not a loan, gave, gift, gone, never coming back, $27.2 million. India, we gave $126.6 million. Brazil, we gave $26 million. And here's the one that just kills me, Russia. We gave Russia $71.5 million in federal aid, in foreign aid from the federal government. 71 $1.5 million to Russia. Hey, who's giving us foreign aid? I'd like to know what the stats are for all the countries that are giving the U.S. foreign aid, giving us money. Well, they're not. None of them are giving us any money. They're taking it, and then they're buying treasuries that we, in other words, giving us a loan. When they buy treasury bonds, they're giving us a loan. That's how we get a loan from the federal government, by selling treasury bonds. Here's another good one. Mexico received $316.7 million, and Egypt $255.7 million. And yet, despite the massive outgoings in foreign aid, the receiving countries hold trillions of dollars in U.S. Treasury bonds. China is the largest holder with $1.1 trillion. Brazil holds $193.5 billion. Let's see, who's got a big number? That's it, Brazil has $193 billion, almost $194 billion. In fact, almost $200 billion in treasury securities that is a loan to us, and we gave them $25 million last year. Amazing. What else? Article had to say, foreign aid is earmarked for causes like HIV, AIDS prevention, combating weapons of mass destruction, and tuberculosis, and on and on. Well, why don't those countries pay for those things? And they've got trillions in treasury bonds of ours, so why aren't they paying for that themselves? It's kind of ridiculous. Well, anyway, if countries could afford to buy our debt, I would think perhaps they could afford to fund assistant programs of their own. I mean, does that make sense to you folks out there? You know, feel free to call in and tell me what you think. But some people would say that, it's buying goodwill. We're buying goodwill by giving countries money. We're kind of basically buying their friendship. You know what I say to that? Screw that. Screw that. They need us way more than we need them. Now, here's some of the top countries receiving the most aid. Colombia got $461 million, so almost half a billion. We already went over Egypt, $255 million. Thailand, $16 million. Yeah, it's hard to understand, and it sort of boggles my mind as to why we would be giving so much money to countries that are loaning us money. You know, that's almost like going to the bank and saying, hey, I need a loan. Will you loan me $10,000? And the bank says, sure, no problem. And that'll be at a 2% interest rate over 4 years. Great, that sounds like a great deal. I'll take it. $10,000, 2% interest rate. And oh, by the way, we've got a great program for the homeless going on here. Let's not even make it homeless. We got some folks that work here at the bank that could use a little help. Do you think you could give us some money? You mean loan you money? No. Give us money. Oh, sure. Why not? Yeah, let's see. Out of the $10,000 that I just borrowed from you, let me give your employees a couple $100. How about that? I mean, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. Who would ever do that? But we're doing it as a country. And I know some people say, well, Tom, it goes much farther than that, it goes beyond that. You know what? I'm tired of the farther beyond that and the political correctness or the politics and the cronyism. You know what? It's over. Stop. Don't do it anymore. Get rid of it. No more. It's my money. It's our money as taxpayers. We've got to start telling our representatives no. And when they say, well, there are going to be consequences not giving money. You know what? I tell you what. How are things working out right now so far? How are they? You know, the U.S. is at a lower approval rating under this president than it was in the last year of George Bush's administration. So how are things working out by handing out all this graft money, huh? How's that working out? You know what? Why don't we give it a try? How about we do this? For 4 years, we don't give anybody any money. For 4 years. And let's see how that goes. I'll bet we're in a lot better shape 4 years from now than we are today by handing out all this money and also having to borrow all this money from foreign nations. I don't know. You can, call me and tell me what you think. But that's one of the problems we're facing here right now. So anyway, and I mentioned there that our approval rating is at a lower rate than it was in the last Bush administration. In fact, Obama's approval rating right now, if you know, I didn't pull up the specific the specific article, but if you take a look at it, you'll find that the president right now, Obama, is at a lower approval rating himself than President Bush was in his last year of his presidency. And out of five of the six countries that were polled, Arab countries that were polled, President Obama's approval rating is lower than the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Yeah, lower than him. So Arabs have more respect for that nut job than they do for Barack Obama. I find that really kind of crazy. Well, we're going to try dialing out to
I'm sorry,
Jennifer.
But the person you called has a voicemail box that has not been set up yet.
Oh, boy.
Goodbye.
Okay. So we're going to try calling Jill right now. So stand with me. I've got a couple of phone numbers for her. And I'm not Jill, but Jennifer Dyer. Because I got an email from her today saying that, hey, no problem, see you at 4 o'clock. I hope she understands it's 4 o'clock. She knows it's 4 o'clock Eastern time, and she's out on the West Coast. So let's see if we can just give her a call and get a hold of her. And she'll probably be like, oh, gee, I totally forgot. That's what happens. And really, if Paula were here with me, she would have, you know, made the call. And while we were talking.
Hello?
Hello, Jennifer?
Yes.
Hey, Tom Garcia. How are you doing?
Hey, how you doing?
Good. We're on the air, live right now. Can you talk?
Super.
Okay. The article you wrote a couple weeks ago, I've already introduced you, but why don't we do this? Let people know about your background, and then tell us what you're up to and how they can find out more about you and your writing, and I think you're writing a book right now, and give us a preview of that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm a retired Navy veteran, 20 years as a Naval Intelligence Officer, and my blog is called The Optimistic Conservative. You can, if you do a Google search, it'll be the top thing that comes up, or you can go to theoptimisticconservative.wordpress.com, and I've also written for Hot Air and the Weekly Standard, and for Commentary, they have a blog called Contentions. So you can find my writing at any of those places. And the book that I'm working on is about the Cold War, and what it's the hook for it is basically what Reagan did differently, how he was different from all his predecessors, and why that made such a difference in bringing the Cold War to an end.
Uh-huh.
So
excellent.
That's what we're looking at.
Good. Well, sounds good. Now, in the news, the hot thing, and you just can't hardly get away from it, it's either a two-headed snake or we've got, you know, the debt ceiling and the economy and raising taxes all kind of rolled up in one thing. But you wrote this great article called It's Not the Entitlements, It's the Discretionary Spending. And I'll let you talk about that, but I got to tell you this. First, many times on the show, I've talked about the size of the federal government and discretionary spending. I even wrote an op-ed a couple years ago about the alternate engine for the F-35, and that this did not make sense to spend all that money on an alternate engine that was going to be built over in the U.K. So it wasn't going to create U.S. jobs, it was going to create British jobs. And it really was bringing home the pork to some degree to constituents, even though it wasn't going to really create jobs. Some of the congressmen that were really pushing for that were pushing for it because it was going to create some jobs in their districts, but not many. The vast majority of the jobs were going to be created. So even just for a little bit, we were willing, with nine partners, nine other countries, we were willing to take on the entire burden of an alternate engine that isn't needed, and I made the justification for that. But that's one of those things that you call non-mandatory military spending. We have lots of non-mandatory military spending that sometimes gets called discretionary, but it's you know, really the reality is it's military, it's Department of Defense, but it's non-mandatory. And whenever you hear non-mandatory, to me, that's a code word for pork. Not always, but generally it's pork. But when you add up the total size of the federal government, the executive branch, and we're not talking Medicare, Social Security, any of that, those things. It's $1.3 trillion in size on an annual budget basis. And so in any case, your article went right into discretionary spending. So why don't you tell us about the article, why you wrote it, and what the article, the gist of the article is, and any of the details, so we can enlighten people on why. And quite frankly, I said this a year ago. I warned Republicans, and I'd run for Congress, so I do have some connections and things like that because of my campaign. And I warned people, I said, do not go after entitlements. It's going to scare people, and the Democrats will use it to demonize the Republican Party. Go after discretionary spending. And the executive branch departments themselves. Nobody's going to be riding in the street if we slash the Department of Interior. It's just not going to happen. But you even mention Granny's Social Security check in any way, even if you're going to add to it, it doesn't matter. You'll be demonized. And what do? They didn't follow my advice, so I guess I don't count for too much. But we're seeing that actually play out right now. But anyway, I'll let you run with it now, Jennifer, and tell us about that article.
Okay, very good. Yeah, the reason I wrote the article is that it's hard to get people to focus on the fact that discretionary spending, for one thing, is the problem that you mentioned. For another thing, it's Obama's bread and butter. He's a Chicago politician, and you know their whole deal is finding ways to rent seek on, you know, at the public's expense, and that is a lot of what he's doing. I did another interview earlier this week and pointed out in it something that Andrew Stiles published at National Review back in February, which is that Obama's 2012 budget proposal includes a 35% increase for the Department of Education funding over its 2008 level, a 22% increase for the Department of Energy over the 2008 level, a 30% increase for the EPA over its 2008 level, and the list just goes on.
Mm-hmm.
That is where Obama, that's how he tends constituencies. And, you know, it's not just the functions of those departments, it's the employment that people can get out of any federal department. The you know, he has increased government jobs, unlike, you know, his predecessors who were more interested in, who were at least, you know, understood that they were being forced to cut government jobs. Obama has increased them and calls it stimulus spending when he does it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a political power move for him to increase this discretionary spending. So that's one aspect of it. But another is the sheer numbers. I was looking at some figures when I was putting that piece together and realized that if he had not run the stimulus through in 2009, the $787 billion bill, we could have paid for all the increases in Social Security and Medicare that have occurred in the last couple of years because the baby boomers are all turning 65. And That is a big deal. Between 2010 and 2011, spending on Social Security and Medicare jumped, respectively, by about $100 billion each. And, you know, of course, $200 billion per year, if you look at 2010 and 2011, is $400 billion. Well, $787 billion is still more than that. So, you know, we saw those increases coming. A point I want to get across to people is that's what we have an actuary for, is to see those increases coming. We knew they were coming. Now, the smart thing to do is to not increase your discretionary spending if you know that your entitlement spending is going to go up.
Yeah.
But instead of doing the smart thing, Obama increased the discretionary spending and increased it dramatically. So we need to be looking at that. Discretionary spending is something that really needs to be slashed to the bone because entitlement spending is just going to grow. And one more point about this, the federal revenues have declined about 13% from their 2008 levels. In 2008, we took in about $2.52 trillion in federal revenues, and the federal spending was 2.8 something trillion. You know, that seemed like a big deficit at the time. It's tiny compared to what we've seen in the last 3 years. But in 2011, we're on track for about $2.17 trillion in federal revenues. That's a decline of about 13%. And yet, even though we know that entitlement spending had to go up over the last 3 years, particularly because of all the people turning 65, but we've also had welfare spending go up because of all the people losing jobs. With all those things that we understood were coming and had to be coming, Obama increased discretionary spending even though revenues were going down.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, you know who Alex de Tocqueville is, and for anybody out there who doesn't know, he was a French guy who came over and toured around early in the development, during the Jefferson era of our country, and looked around and was pretty impressed with a country that had set up a constitution to govern itself rather than government governing the people. But here's one of his famous quotes. He said, "The American Republic will endure until the day Congress discovers it can bribe the public with the public's money." This guy is the ultimate at bribing the public with the public money. I mean, people have to be stupid to look at this and think, yeah, I want this and I want that and I want this and I want that and the government will give it to me. Well, it's either your money or it's somebody else's, but it's not just coming out of thin air. And eventually it'll be coming from everybody, and that's really the direction we're headed. But the one thing about, say, GDP, for example, I got a nice chart the other day and took a look at, as a percentage of GDP, where the debt has gone, the annual deficits have gone, and they've skyrocketed since Democrats took over in 2007 and actually even peaked up even at a higher angle under this president. But one of the things I see as a problem is I see a lot of proposals, and we've seen them come and go, that talk about, well, let's, you know, cap the federal government to a percentage of GDP. The problem is not one of these proposals talks about what happens when the GDP is tanking. What they do is they freeze government. So it's like a ratchet. You know, anybody that's out there a mechanic, well, how's a ratchet work if you're trying to put in a bolt? Well, you can pull it back to the left, you know, to the right to tighten it, and then as you go to the left, we're talking clockwise, and maybe I'm making this too complicated, but anyway, then it starts pushing that, screwing that bolt in. But then when you go back the other direction, it doesn't make the bolt go the other way. It just gets it ready to go the other way. So as the economy cycles up and down, every time the economy's up, government's going to grow as a percentage of GDP. But when the economy goes down, it just simply freezes. So it's always constantly ratcheting up. And that's a problem that nobody seems to want to address. Have you noticed that?
Oh, absolutely. That, I mean, that's certainly an issue. I think one of our big problems is this overall idea of trying to always work off percentages of numbers and values that are bound to change. There was a time when we thought of government in terms of providing specific services, and you know they cost a certain amount, and so that's how much government needs to spend. That was back before we had a percentage-based federal income tax. And ever since we started with that percentage-based federal income tax, everything has had, you know, people analyze everything the federal government does in terms of percentages of economic indicators. And I'm not so sure that's a good idea. I think we should be looking at what should government cost based on the things that we agree it should be doing, and then that's what the bill is, and this is how we're going to pay it.
Right.
Rather than thinking government needs to represent a certain percentage of our GDP, or you know, taxes need to be a percentage of what we spend each month or what we earn and so forth.
Yeah. Well, we got a bunch of people in the chat room, and Atlanta Talk, I love what this person had to say about reducing the size of government agencies. But the Department of Agriculture had at the most 400 employees at the turn of the last century and served 10 million farmers. Today, they have more than 100,000 employees and serve about 1 million farmers. I mean, this really is the difference in mindset between liberals and conservatives. Liberals are constantly looking for how can government help the people? What can government do? And Barack Obama famously said, you know, the Constitution, unfortunately, doesn't tell us what government must do for the people. I mean, he doesn't have a fundamental understanding of the intent of it. And I can tell you this. He said he was a constitutional law professor. He was a 14th Amendment lecturer, and only one portion of the 14th Amendment. This guy doesn't know anything about the Constitution, and I can prove it. When he made that statement, he talked about the Constitution being full of negative liberties. And I don't know if you've looked into that deep into the Constitution, but and for the listeners out there, a negative liberty is something that is not written down. It's not a bad thing. It's just not written down. In other words, the Constitution doesn't say that you can or can't fish on Sundays, therefore you can. Now, if you put it in the Constitution, you can fish on Sunday. Now, it's a positive liberty because it positively expresses what you can do. But a negative liberty just means it's not in there. So he went and said the Constitution is full of negative liberties. It can't be full of negative liberties because then they would all be positive liberties. So he doesn't even understand the fundamentals of the Constitution. But yeah, he's a law professor and constitutional professor. The guy is clueless. So, but that's the fundamental differences. The liberals want to do stuff for us. But here's the problem. I talked about this on the show the other day, and I used to do a bunch of consulting for different industries, and I had come up with this design, Jennifer, for a web, a spider web. And when problems occur in an organization, whether they be safety issues, if I was going to do a safety audit or going in to do employee issues and looking at culture, corporate culture, what I always found was that there was an underlying cause. The underlying cause, if you could eliminate that, you eliminate the whole web. But if you just go after all the little symptoms that underlying cause is causing, then you're just going after just symptoms. And that web can continue to grow and get bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think that's the problem with our federal government. Every time it wants to do something for us, it's spinning that web a little bigger. But that web isn't very effective, and all it's doing is catching people in it. People are getting stuck in it. It never seems to work right. And if we go back to the design of our government and the structure put in place with the Constitution, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson made it very clear. But James Madison, his version of the Constitution is what was adopted. If anybody would know, he would know. And he said that the purpose of the federal government is to handle external issues, such as, you know, foreign policy, foreign negotiations, war, etc. And social and civil issues are to be handled by the states. So as this federal government gets bigger and bigger and bigger and tries to handle more and more social issues, it just doesn't work because that was not the structure and that's not the way it was designed to work. And so the states lose more and more sovereignty. The federal government gets more and more power, and yet it never can exercise it well. And I've actually had a few liberals say to me, well, what if the states aren't doing something that ought to be done? Who's going to do it? And I said, you know, you make a good point. Somebody maybe ought to do it, but the federal government doesn't have the authority to do it. And that's the problem. We're really just eroding our Constitution. And this whole debt ceiling talk, really, if you think about it, the laws are in place. The laws are in place so that if you hit the debt ceiling and you really don't have the money and shouldn't be borrowing more money, then it forces you to prioritize and cut back. But this administration and the liberals don't want to do that. They just want to keep plowing forward. You know, when do you think, Jennifer, we'd reach a point where we cannot get any loans, printing money will just accelerate inflation and then ultimately destroy the dollar, and then we can't raise the debt anymore? I mean, where do you think we would hit that point if we just keep pressing forward like this?
Obviously that depends on what we do about this August 2nd date. But I think it could occur within the next 18 months if we just raise the debt ceiling by $2 trillion and continue on without any significant changes.
Yeah. I think I'm not a conspiracy guy, but Jefferson was convinced that Washington in his second term and Adams wanted to create problems. Though, and of course, the government was very young and the country was very young, so it would have been quite easy to do back then compared to now. It takes a lot more now, but wanted to create enough problems that the government would collapse and they could build a monarchy on its ruins. I don't know that that's what's going on here, but it's very clear that this president and a lot of his cronies are socialists. And if they can destroy our economy and, create a situation where we go, hey, the only way to solve this is government's got to step in and really just take control. And you think about where that's happened in the past. It's happened many times in history. take control, and now they can implement what they want to implement. The Constitution is no longer a barrier. I don't think it's much of a barrier now when you have people talking about the 14th Amendment giving the president some leeway to raise the debt ceiling himself. And I did a show on this at the beginning of a show, so I'm not going to go over it again. You can go back to, I think, Monday, and I laid the case for why if the president raises the debt ceiling unilaterally, he's actually violating the 14th Amendment. It's very, very simple to understand. He's violating it, not complying with it. So, but this is where we've become a country where up is down and down is up. These guys, we frequently do shows, Jennifer, where we just talk about all the lies that came out that day. I've never in my life, and I've followed politics since I was a kid, seen so many politicians just outright lie. Get on TV and just blatantly lie. I don't know if you see it that way or not, but I predicted this. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean it starts to get pretty hard on your morale to see them just lying and they're not called on it.
Yeah.
The people they're talking to directly, if it's NBC or CBS, CNN, whoever it might be, whoever they're talking to doesn't call them on it directly. They just let them make a false case, state things that are full of falsehoods, and they don't call them on it. They don't challenge them.
Yeah. Well, there was just a guy on TV today. Of course, it would only be on Fox, but he did a little YouTube video. I know quite a few freshman congressmen are doing this right now, doing little YouTube videos where they've gotten email throughout the week from their constituents, and they answer questions. So it's not really quite a town hall, but you're getting to see your representative addressing issues that people are asking about that very week. And so I think it's a little more – we're a visual nation, and we like to not just get a newsletter or a press release, but actually see the person, answering some questions live. And one of the things he did as he was talking about this debt ceiling was he said, the president is a liar. He's lied to you. And I'm glad to see somebody do that, because if I had gotten elected, I'd be doing the same thing. But he absolutely is. And we pointed out an article yesterday from let me pull it up right here. It's Terrence Jeffrey, where back on Wednesday, or actually Tuesday, he said, official Treasury reports show coffers are full enough to cover entitlement programs, veterans, federal salaries, interest without borrowing a dime. The next day,
That's exactly right.
Yeah, exactly. So, at some point, something's got to be done. We can't just keep going along like that. But the answer is, okay, we're going to start scaling back. I mean, you probably see this in your neighborhood, and I've bought a few things off of Craigslist recently, and I see people trying to unload stuff left and right, expensive items. They need money. So they're kind of shedding weight, and that's what we're expected to do in tough times, but the government is not willing to do that. In fact, the government wants to rack up more debt and more debt and more debt. But as Americans, we know that when times are tough and you're trying to, tighten your belt a little bit, that's what you do. And so I see all kinds of things being sold on Craigslist and eBay and in the local papers that I'm sure people really don't want to sell, but they're having to do it. But the federal government just refuses to do that.
Well, sure. I mean, if you look at how a household runs its budget, if it wants to remain solvent, if you have an income revenue problem, then you start cutting back on your expenditures instead of increasing them, which Obama did with discretionary spending, even though everyone knew that entitlement spending had to go up because more people were going to fall into the categories where they were entitled to receive benefits. I mean, entitlement spending had to go up in 2009, 10, and 11, and yet Obama increased discretionary spending, even though revenues were on a constant downslope.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, you may have seen the article. I saw her on TV a couple times, but I'm not going to even try and pronounce her name. It's a French name. It ought to be easy. I think it's Véronique de Rougier.
Oh,
but it looks like
Rougier. Right.
Okay. Yeah. I speak Spanish, French, and English. The English and Spanish, I would butcher it, but I'll just call her Veronica, an economist at George Mason University? Yeah, George Mason University. Wrote this great article and went through basically the debt ceiling debate and that kind of thing. But one thing she pointed out that nobody has pointed out, I've done it on the show a couple times, is that the U.S. could conservatively, and she and a colleague went through and came up with a conservative list of items that the U.S. could start selling off, just like your neighbors are doing, that would add up to $2.4 trillion. So he wants a new debt ceiling of $2.5 trillion, correct? Well, he's just got to sell off some items, and one of the items she listed were the TARP assets. There's like $180 billion right there, but there's all kinds of assets and even some land that could be sold off by the federal government that could raise, in a fairly short amount of time, almost $2.4 trillion. But the government refuses to do that. Unlike us Americans, that, as you said, we operate our household one way, the federal government refuses to because I guess they're just too good, better than everybody else. So it's very disheartening, but we'll get you out of here in a few seconds. We've hammered that one pretty good, but I want to talk about a couple of your other articles. You just did one recently, I guess yesterday, the summer of 1980, where you talked about remembering that summer in Oklahoma City, but you just saw somebody interviewed who's saying, boy, this is the hottest, hottest summer I can remember. Tell us about the gist of that article.
Yeah, well, the reason I wrote the article is that they interviewed someone in Oklahoma City who said, we've issued more excessive heat warnings this year than ever before. Well, they started issuing heat warnings in 2001. That's when the guidelines were put out for doing that. So they weren't doing it in 1980. 1980 was the, and I've gotten so many responses on this, it's the year everyone remembers because it was one of the three hottest summers. It wasn't even the hottest one. 1936 was the hottest one. But 1980 is the one I was alive for, and it was hideous, and it was actually much worse than this summer for virtually everyone in the eastern half of the United States. So the point I wanted to make was that, the anecdote that pops up in somebody's interview today or yesterday or whenever is not a signal about the direction the climate's going. Weather comes in cycles, and it has been this bad before, and it'll be this bad again, but it'll get better in between.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely agree. I mean, we did an entire show once on climate change, and Al Gore, another full-faced liar, we played a quote of him, and I proved how he actually completely flipped the truth backwards, and he did that at the very beginning of his little movie there, An Inconvenient Truth. The truth is very inconvenient for him, by the way, but, the planet's somewhere like around 5 billion years old, but in its current form, with life and everything, I think it's only about 500 million years old. But when you think about how long it's been here, and the very ice core samples that Al Gore uses in his movie to explain and lie, actually, about the truth, reveal that we've had, in the last 1 million years, 8 ice ages, and that for the most part, the planet is cold and almost uninhabitable most of the time compared to what it is right now. We're in a warm cycle. So when somebody says that the polar caps are melting, the polar caps have been melting since the last ice age began to end 60,000 years ago. So who started that melting and who's kept it going all this time? I mean, you can be a third grader and understand these concepts. But when people lie to you and take the data and basically flip it upside down, you can, I guess if you're not paying attention, you could. So in any case, yeah, I thought that was a great article, and you point out a really good, very good point about that. And the other article that got my attention that did recently was back on July 6th. We have a regulation problem, not a revenue problem. Want to tell us about that?
Yeah, that again is something that I think that in some ways that's even more important to think about than discretionary spending. Regulation is stifling our economy, is killing our economy. 40 years ago, it was starting to get bad. Today, it is many times as bad, and people don't even realize it, because most regulations are implemented through businesses. They're regulations on what business has to do or not do, and it all costs money. It prevents businesses from starting. It makes things cost more. It, prevents businesses from expanding and adding jobs. There are so many things that regulation does. Regulation is our big problem right now. If we want to get out of our recession, we cannot do it if we don't start lifting regulations. Some of them are easy to see, like the prohibitions on offshore drilling. Obama has had the moratorium on it, but the states, California, Florida, some other states on the East Coast, actively prohibit drilling off their shores. California could wipe out its annual deficit overnight if it would just allow offshore drilling. It's stupid and suicidal to not do it, and yet we're doing it, and it's costing jobs. It cost tens of thousands of jobs for Obama to impose his moratorium on offshore drilling. And, you know, those are just the things that are most visible. There's all kinds of stuff that's much less visible because only businesses and their lawyers ever end up seeing it or knowing that it's happening or dealing with it. But it all costs money, and it stifles economic growth.
Exactly. Now, can you think of anything in the Constitution that allows the federal government to create all this regulation?
Well, of course not. I think we're probably in agreement that the Commerce Clause does not.
Yeah. Right. The Commerce Clause, and we talk about this.
Commerce Clause.
Yeah, the Commerce. People can talk about what the intent was or whatever. We've got activist judges that rule that Commerce Clause extends to everything that commerce that affects commerce or creates commerce. So most people out there don't really think about it, but commerce is a financial transaction. In other words, I buy a book from you and hand you money. The transaction of me giving you the money and taking the book is commerce. You making the book, you writing the book, you printing the book is not commerce. The way I earned the money to give you the money, the car I drove in to give you the money, all of that is not commerce. But the Supreme Court activist judges over years have ruled, in order to bring in more money to the government, essentially, and give it more regulation, have ruled that all of those events surrounding the actual transaction are a part of commerce. And that's a lie. They're not commerce. You know, so that's the problem. We need a lot of things that need to be done in the government, I think, to change course. And a lot of people talk about, you know, a balanced budget amendment and a few other things. I really quite honestly believe we need an amendment that clarifies the Commerce Clause and says that the federal government, this was the intent, the federal government in exercising the Commerce Clause is to do so to ensure fairness among transactions that occur across state lines. And fairness is probably not the right word, but maybe legal. You know, all transactions are legal transactions, but it has nothing to do with what leads to those transactions. So we've got, you know, a D.C. Federal Circuit Court judge that ruled that you making a decision whether you want to buy health care or not, that's commerce, and therefore the federal government can control your decision and thought process. I mean, there's no end to it. There's absolutely no end to it. So that's something that this Obamacare, and I was saying it 3 years ago when they were discussing the health care bill. I said I would go to groups and I would say, I was campaigning at the time, of course, so when I would be before a group, I'd say, what's the worst part of Obamacare or this legislation, this pending legislation that we've seen some bits of? And people would pick out certain things, and I'd say, no, this will absolutely destroy the Constitution because it will reduce the Constitution to a single phrase, the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause will override everything. And think about it for a moment. Let's say the government wants to stop elections. They all want to stay in power and they want to stop elections. You say, well, they can't do that. Well, they absolutely can under the Commerce Clause. Do elections affect interstate commerce? Absolutely. So the federal government has the authority to regulate elections. And they'll just say, you know, for the good of the country right now, we're going to stop all elections. I mean, there's no end to it. There's absolutely no end to it. So that's the danger. And here's the problem with what liberals want to do with the Commerce Clause is they're like somebody who has sold their soul to the devil. They know what they want right now, and they'll do anything to get it. They don't care about the consequences on down the road. And I've asked many a liberal person, so what protection do you have from government when government decides elections have stopped and we're suspending civil rights? Well, we'll vote them out of office. No, I just said they're, you know, stopping elections. Well, we just won't stand for it. What are you going to do? You know what you're going to have to do at that point? You've let it go to that point where government has so much power it can do anything it wants to you. Guess what? We're going to be the next Egypt or, you know, Yemen or, you know, whatever. Any of those Arab countries, revolution. We're going to have to fight a bloody revolution to take our country back. And I don't want us to ever get to that point. But if liberals have their way, that's where we'll end up. We'll either end up like Venezuela, poor, poor, poor. But all the same, with free health care, I mean, look, Chavez, he's going to have to leave. He had to leave to go to Cuba to get a cyst removed. It was cancerous. He can't get chemo in his own country, and he can't get it in Cuba. But Michael Moore tells us that their health care is better than ours. Wow, that works out just great, doesn't it? The reality is it's terrible, and we don't want to go down that path. So liberals are like people that have sold their souls to the devil. They really are, and they never have an answer for how we can stop a runaway government. Conservatives do, on the other hand, if we start following the Constitution protects us, and that's all we need. But see, they don't care. They have their issue. They have their causes, and they will do anything to achieve those causes, regardless of the destruction that leads up to that cause and regardless of the destruction after the cause. So in any case, all right, I'll let you have the last word, Jennifer.
Okay, well, I was going to say that's exactly right, and it's so interesting that you put it in those terms, because something that I always remember when we talk about the Commerce Clause is one of the key rulings that allowed it to metastasize to how it's being used today, and that was when the Civil Rights Bill was challenged on the basis that the federal government had no authority to regulate who could be accepted as customers in a diner, you know, inside a state, where there was no basis for the federal authority that was usurped to do that. The Supreme Court ruled that the diner was an instance of interstate commerce, regardless of whether it bought anything or sold anything across state lines. It was the Commerce Clause that the Supreme Court held allowed the federal government to come in and regulate something like that. And that was the beginning of the end of the slippery slope.
Right.
And, you know, nobody wants to see black people denied the ability to go in and eat at a diner. No one wants that. And, you know, that's a bad thing. I think we can all agree it's bad if someone wants to discriminate in that way.
Right.
But the Supreme Court ruling that the federal government had the authority to come in and regulate that is what has put us on the slope that's gotten us to where we are today.
Yeah,
with
exactly.
The Commerce Clause basically meaning if you have a pulse, the federal government can regulate everything you do.
Yep, there you go. And, you know, our founders actually started talking about, Jefferson talked about some of the loopholes in the Constitution. He was our third president, so it had been, you know, 8 years with Washington, 4 years with Adams. So here we are, 9 years into this country, and he's already mentioning the General Welfare Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause as being loopholes that had already been abused. But they never envisioned the Commerce Clause. I know if we went back in time and asked them, the Commerce Clause is going to become what you predicted with the General Welfare Clause. And I'm sure they would have looked at us and said, how could that happen? And all we would have to do, though, Jefferson did understand this, all we would have to do is say, activist Supreme Court judges. And he would go, damn, I knew that was going to happen. And but here's the quote, and I'll do this off the top of my head because I don't have it here in front of me, so hopefully we can do this well. But I think you can insert the Commerce Clause in its place because that's where it's gone. But he thought it would be the General Welfare Clause. And he said, they are not to do anything they please to provide for the general welfare, but only to raise revenue for that purpose. And that's right there in Section 8. Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 1, talking about taxation for the general welfare. But the next clause, or it's down there a little further, the Commerce Clause, I think the rest of his quote is applicable. He said, giving a distinct and independent power the authority to do whatever would be for the good of the union renders all preceding and subsequent enumerations of power completely useless. In other words, every other enumeration of power in the Constitution doesn't matter. It's obliterated by allowing us to use the Commerce Clause because it's for the good of the union, just as you gave in your example, that Supreme Court ruling. And he said it reduces the instrument to that of a single phrase, giving a Congress the authority to do whatever would be for the good of the United States. And as they would be the sole judges of good and evil, they will also have the power to do whatever evil they choose. And that's precisely what's going to happen with the Commerce Clause here. So he was right in that it would go that way somehow. He just thought at the time it was going to be the General Welfare Clause, and I'm certain nobody ever, because I've done a lot of reading back in that era of Madison's presidency and Jefferson's presidency, and nobody ever talked about the Commerce Clause being an issue, and it really didn't become an issue until the 1900s, and it's just grown from there, as you said. So in any case, interesting stuff, good articles. We appreciate having you come on, Jennifer. And one more time, where can people find your articles and information?
My base blog is The Optimistic Conservative, theoptimisticconservative.wordpress.com, and that has an about page, and then it has all links to the other places that I write blog posts for, and that's the first stop to make.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks for coming on, and we'll be in touch. We'll keep an eye out for your articles and talk about them as articles come along that we like, and I have a feeling we're going to like a lot of them. So keep up the good work. Appreciate it. And you have a great rest of the week. Thanks, Jennifer.
Okay. Thank you. Great to be with you.
Thanks. Take care. All right, everybody. Well, that was a special broadcast Thursday, having Jennifer Dyer come on, the Optimistic Conservative. Great articles. You just heard her talk about some of that stuff. Well researched and written. And we will be back on Tuesday. Of course, Michael Cutler is broadcasting here for me on Fridays over the summer, so don't miss his show tomorrow. Always a great show. He gets a lot of people listening to the show because he used to have a radio show, so he's got a pretty good following to begin with. Michael Cutler, 30-year INS officer. Don't miss his show tomorrow. And then we'll be back on Tuesday, Paul and myself, and then Ambassador Escudero on Wednesday. Thanks for listening to the American Hour, and have a great rest of the week.
Listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.